Want to make a difference in your community but not sure how? Go to GoFundMe.com right now and start a GoFundMe. Seriously. Your next fundraiser doesn't have to start in a school parking lot or a church basement. You can start a GoFundMe today in just minutes. Fundraise for yourself, a friend, or family member, or an organization. All that matters is that you care about them. GoFundMe is the trusted place to fundraise for what you care about. With no pressure to hit your fundraising goal, but tons of tools to help you reach it, you can confidently start fundraising right now. Whether it's creative, local, or critical, your cause matters. And there's a reason why GoFundMe is backed by millions and chosen by fundraisers everywhere. It works, and it matters. GoFundMe helps you make a real difference. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com. This is a commercial message brought to you by GoFundMe.
Worried about your future in tech? Master new skills, accelerate your team's impact, and redefine what's possible with Pluralsight. We're more than just another online learning platform. We're shattering the skills gap and shaping future generations of technologists. Transform your work. Transform your team. Ready to tap in? Visit us at Pluralsight.com to learn more.
It's The Wonky Show. We're talking free speech, the January UCAS deadline, and a new report about universities and the media. It's all coming up.
I mean, I think the biggest thing that we've been seeing, and I thought this the minute I saw that headline, was we are literally in the middle of a pandemic. What is this government's priorities?
It's you like the woke wardens.
Honestly, like yesterday we got that figure yesterday that 1 billion has been spent on unused accommodation, and the government thinks it's a priority to hire a free speech champion when students aren't even able to go on campus because...
Welcome to The Wonky Show, your direct way into this week's higher education news, policy and analysis. I'm Wonky's editor-in-chief, reporting from Wonky's lockdown studio, and here to help fry the policy pancake for me this week are three brilliant guests. In London, we have Hilary Jebiabibio, NUS Vice President for Higher Education. Hilary, your highlight of the week, please.
Hiya, Mark. Thanks for having me on. My highlight is this week I've invested in a heated blanket, and I surely did not know that... you could get into bed already warm, so I've been really enjoying that.
Lovely. In South East London, we have Richard Bradner, Director of the UPP Foundation. Richard, your highlight of the week, please.
Hi, everybody. My highlight of the week is actually a really nice thing that I found out this week. My wife's grandfather, who was an industrialist in the 60s and 70s, actually helped set up the teaching company scheme, which was the forerunner to KTPs. So I didn't know that before, so I was pretty impressed by that. And
And in Watford, we have Wonky's own Jim Dickinson. Jim, your highlight of the week, please.
Yeah, so my highlight this week, so you might have seen that television's Anne Robinson was announced as the new presenter of apparent student favourite Countdown. And, you know, for me, the fun thing was watching offence archaeologists dig up all the reasons why she should be sacked from that job by watching lots of old clips of The Weakest Link where she was genuinely and horrifyingly offensive.
Nasty show. And I like to think we're much nicer to our guests on The Wonky Show than The Weakest Link. But let's start the week with the big story. It's Tuesday's announcement by the Westminster government that it plans to legislate for freedom of speech at universities. There's a lot to talk about here. Jim, get us started.
Well, I mean, you say Tuesday's announcement. It was all leaked. I mean, all the headlines were leaked to the Telegraph on Sunday, which then, of course, I mean, you know, props to the Mail on Sunday's, you know, night desk editor who nicked the story, as the Mail often does, and rewrote it as Woke Warden, which lots of people thought was mildly amusing on Sunday. So, yes, a free speech champion is to be appointed by... government and plonked onto the Office for Students Board with similar analogous powers to that of the Director of Fair Access. Although the slight difference is that they would have ombudsperson powers over matters that relate to free speech and academic freedom, which, you know, we'll obviously come to. And then a few other bits. So the general duty that's already there will be toughened up. And, you know, some suggestions about how universities might comply with that toughening up are in this document. And the, you know, various other bits and bobs, including the idea that students' unions would be brought directly under the auspices of the Education Act 1986, which covers freedom of speech in universities. What's more broadly going on? I mean, we could fill not only this podcast, but plenty of others. A few things strike me just to kick us off. I do think it is extraordinary and important that we've got 15,000 words here. And when you compare that to the length of the, you know, response to the TEF review or the interim auger review, that just doesn't feel right somehow in the middle of a pandemic. And a lot of the commentary actually from both sides was about, is this really the right priority at the right time, which I thought was interesting. The actual proposals are extraordinary because they don't look like they would work. So if you give a free speech champion on the OFS board ombudsperson powers, it's not clear where a complaint that a student might have that's about harassment or fitness to practice is easy to slice out from matters of, you know, academic freedom and freedom of speech. And it's not clear that that's workable. It's not clear that the proposals on student unions are workable either in the way that they're described. And there's no consultation in this. And the whole thing reads like a bunch of work was done pre-pandemic. It's been kind of rushed out during the pandemic to please a bunch of people. And I find it hard to believe that the actual proposals as written down would survive. And there's a couple of kind of classic, I bet a civil servant has written that in caveats in there, buried in there about, you know, we recognise that we will have to look at this and, you know, think about whether or not this all works in practice with the Office for Students and so on and so on. So, I mean, it's an interesting mixed bag. I think, you know, the most important thing, certainly for me and DK when we looked at it the other day, was that the most important bit of the proposals, which is this toughening up of a duty, actually has to admit that there's already a duty on the Office for Students to look after, you know, to look at free speech and academic freedom. And really what the proposal does is it says you should take two sub bits of an existing duty, lift them out, make them their own duty, and then change the language around that duty slightly, which reminds me, for listeners of a certain vintage and of a certain persuasion, reminds me very much of compositing motions at NUS National Conference, where, you know, someone would turn up and say, I want the two lines of my of that motion to become their own motion, and I want to propose it. You know, it's all very kind of odd. And, you know, you're left with the impression that this is a piece of politics rather than a serious piece of, you know, regulation that might impact, you know, the real culture of universities.
Well, I'm going to come back to that. I just want to zoom out for a second. And Richard, I want you to give your best effort at explaining the government's motivation here and the problem they're trying to solve. And then we're going to go back into the detail, and I want to get Hillary's thoughts about some of the impact of some of these measures.
I'm not sure I can really answer what the government's motivation is and their efforts to tackle this issue, because I think my view is slightly different to the government's. I find myself, I suppose, in between the government's position on this and some parts of the sector where they don't think that there's an issue around free speech. And I suppose one of the problems, I think, is that free speech is used as a bit of a catch-all to expose and talk about a variety of issues around the culture of an institution. You know, we know from your work and Wonky's really important work and from OFS data that issues around counselling events and speakers and so on is not really much of an issue. A very tiny proportion of events and speakers have been no platformed and cancelled and so on. A very tiny number of institutions. And so I find, you know, I'm quite sympathetic to students and to student unions and to the NUH when they really sort of find it frustrating that they seem to be blamed for this issue, particularly when students' unions in the main are supporting free speech and are exposing students to debate and new ideas and are doing a really good job around that. Where I do think there's an issue are concerns that are connected to this, which is around diversity of thought and I suppose a monoculture, particularly within the social sciences, humanities and the arts and the academy itself. And I think there's plenty of evidence that there is a, you know, dominated by particular political viewpoints within those areas. And how this really intersects, I suppose, with polarisation in society more broadly. The growing problem, I think, of tolerance on social media. And if you do a daily trawl of academic or university Twitter, you'll see quite a lot of hostility and intolerance, I suggest, there. And in fact, Wonky have been sometimes the victims of that. And the impact that this potentially has on students and staff who might have minority and unfashionable views that go against the grain. Now, I think there needs to be much more research around this, but the best piece, I think, was done by King's in 2019, which showed that there
misquoted in the in the government's paper this week. Yeah,
a much stronger piece of work than the Policy Exchange piece, I think, that did show that, for example, there was a much bigger chilling effect of self-censure amongst sort of conservative and Brexit supporting students in comparison to left-leaning students. You can obviously, that doesn't expose causation, and we can discuss that. And I'm sure if you actually look at do a piece of work and research other students within the community, they're, it might expose other areas of self-censorship and a chilling effect that is probably not as healthy as we'd like it to be. So I think that's really sort of the debate, and it's as much around culture of within universities and the behaviour that we have towards each other.
Hillary, how has this gone down with students and student unions?
I mean, I think the biggest thing that we've been seeing, and I thought this the minute I saw that headline, was we are literally in the middle of a pandemic. What is this government's priorities?
It's like the woke wardens.
Honestly, like, yesterday we got that figure yesterday that 1 billion has been spent on unused accommodation, and the government thinks it's the priority to hire a free speech champion when students aren't even able to go on campus because they'll probably get fined for leaving home, and then they can't even afford their rent or getting to their lectures properly because they don't have the right equipment and can't afford it. And so I think that was the first sort of big reaction, which was like, how much more out of touch is Gavin Williamson with what is actually going on the ground? It just seems so bizarre. I think the other thing is that this is something that we've been anticipating for a really long time. And actually, we've seen that the work that we've been doing with One Key that NUS and One Key and student unions have been doing, but even more so the work that is just ongoing. It's very, very bizarre to us also that despite all of that work, the government just seemed to have blinders on to the fact that anything that isn't fitting their narrative just isn't happening. And so there is no acknowledgement of the fact that existing measures are in place. And I think student unions are feeling really, really annoyed at this point that this government keep flip-flopping from villainizing them to, you know, telling people to engage with their student unions because they're great hubs for student engagement and representation. I just have no idea what this government want to do or what their priorities are anymore with these proposals coming in that just show a lack of awareness of what is actually going on.
It's probably a big ask to put this aside. Putting aside that, question of all the other priorities that the government should be spending its time and bandwidth on when it comes to students and universities, which I completely buy, by the way. Try to put that aside for a second. Hillary, what is there anything in here that you recognise as a valid criticism or something that needs to be tackled in, you know, trying to take it in good faith? What is the issue on campus about free speech that the government is trying to solve?
Look, I think it's really, really important that all students are able to feel that they can use their right to freedom of speech and freedom of expression on campus and in society. And that's something that you'll never find me disagreeing with. Everybody has a right to express what they think or feel. I think what's important is that the government framing this as a freedom of speech crisis where there's such little evidence, let alone no evidence, showing that there is a widespread perception is misguided. Instead of thinking about this being a way of championing existing measures that show that freedom of speech is protected and promoted on campus. And I think for those that don't have confidence that they know what those measures are and what those robust procedures are, I think the priority needs to be on championing those measures and showing exactly what students have that are protecting their right to freedom of speech. I also wanted to add that actually what has to happen in tandem with this is that as much as
AI agents are everywhere, automating tasks and making decisions at machine speed. But agents make mistakes. Just one rogue agent can do big damage before you even notice. Rubrik Agent Cloud is the only platform that helps you monitor agents, set guardrails, and rewind mistakes, so you can unleash agents, not risk. Accelerate your AI transformation at rubrik.com. That's rubrik.com.
So we continue to promote and protect free speech. We must also make sure that students are confident that there are robust measures to protect students from vulnerable communities from being exposed to hate speech as well. And I think that has to go hand in hand with any freedom of speech work that happens. But if I try to see it in good faith, I think that the issue is perception as opposed to there being an actual freedom of speech crisis on campus.
And I would hazard that, I guess, in the same way that, you know, Wonky isn't, and many of, probably most of Wonky's listeners are aren't the target audience for this piece of work. You know, student unions aren't, and the NUS aren't, and the government probably just doesn't care what any of us actually think. I mean,
I sort of agree that the government doesn't care what any of us think. I do think they should care about the impact of their of what they're going to do on the cultural of universities themselves. And I suppose where I find it quite frustrating, being somebody who's not completely unsympathetic to the government's position on some of this, is I actually think what they've come up with is not going to make any difference whatsoever to the actual issue that they're trying to expose. And it often might actually make things worse. So, for example, they're by in terms of the extending legal powers, the appointment of the free speech champion and so on, and putting SUs within the OFS's remit and so on. What they're essentially doing is a very technocratic solution to some of these issues. And I actually think what they're doing is they're exposing universities and students' unions to more legal, financial, and reputational risk. And I do not see how that is going to enhance free speech on campus. Actually, it might make things worse, because you all know, you've all worked in universities. And what I find so weird is that those that are leading this debate within the university sector have worked in universities for decades, and they know that how universities and students' unions and others will respond to this is they're going to try and mitigate the risk. And they're not going to mitigate that risk by because they want to limit free speech, but because they want to limit risk on those organisations. So that means that there'll be bureaucratic ties around this, which might dampen down free speech. And the other issue is that what it does, you know, if you read that paper, which I did a couple of days ago, and you know, the one thing that I sort of agree with is around issues around a chilling effect. But there's no sort of interrogation on how you can improve that and improve the debate within the sector and in enhancing civility and tolerance of different opinions. Nothing whatsoever. And actually, you know, what I fear is that what this is actually going to do is that it's going to entrench positions, because if you position this as sort of in opposition to the sector rather than working with parts of the sector and building a coalition of supporters around this, that people are going to take it in bad faith, and bad faith positions mean you entrench positions. So I actually think that those of you that don't think that there's an issue in free speech on campus should be absolutely delighted with what the government has come up with, because it's going to actually not change anything and perhaps make things worse.
And could I add on the measures? I agree with Richard, and I think if anything, we're taking this as an opportunity to prove that we've got already robust measures. But what I find quite ironic actually is that putting these measures under the remit of the OFS puts them in a tricky position too, as an independent regulator, given that the new chair that the government has appointed still hasn't resigned the whip. And even more so, it just doesn't make sense for how the OFS sits now in the sector in relation to being an independent regulator, as opposed to, you know, an agent of how the government is going to crack down on student unions and all of the woke officers and woke people they seem to harbour.
Mm. I mean, yeah, that brings us nicely onto some of the kind of problems in the detail. And we've got plenty of analysis about this on the site, Jim. I don't want to get us too bogged down, but there are some really glaring contradictions here, aren't there, about the regulatory landscape?
Yeah, I mean, look, one of the problems is this is the age of the crackdown, right? OFS as something that isn't hefty, that is a regulator, feels it has to talk in language of cracking down on the things it doesn't like. And governments, of course, love to crack down on things. And part of the problem is that the tone of all of this is that government doesn't trust OFS, government doesn't trust universities, OFS doesn't trust universities. There's a real lack of trust here in an environment where, you know, I think Richard's right, lots of these problems require complex and subtle interventions into essentially culture rather than kind of overt practice. And you know, therefore the behaviours that you would want need to be clever and subtle. But of course they're not. They're framed in this lack of trust crackdown context and language.
There's a mixture of stuff that OFS can already do, but that OFS hasn't been doing. And, you know, if you really zoom out, one of the key messages in the 15,000 words is, you know, this is a kind of really strange, passive-aggressive way of getting OFS to do something that, for whatever reason, it hasn't done over the past couple of 3 years, right? And, you know, it's like you're sat here thinking, surely there are easier ways for you lot to sort this out behind the scenes than to be launching 15,000-word policy papers. But, I mean, look, the other problem, I think, here is the way in which regulation is trying to be used to solve a kind of social problem. And look, let me give you an example, right? I have tried really hard to lean into some of this stuff from a good faith perspective, but you know, there's a little story that's buried in the 15,000 words, right? So you might remember Equality and Human Rights Commission, a couple of 3 years ago, launched a review into racism on university campuses, racial harassment, and drew some conclusions around, for example, the existence of microaggressions, the need for bystander training, and so on. All quite sensible stuff. You'll also remember that at one point, Sheffield Uni, working with its students' union, launched a programme of kind of student champions who could go and do training on microaggressions with people in halls and clubs and socks. Someone in the tab at Sheffield wrote that up as a student Stasi spying on students. Then Spiked got hold of it. Then, you know, Fleet Street got hold of it. For a week, everyone said, you know, Sheffield has hired a bunch of student Stasi to spy on other students. And that issue actually appears in the 15,000 words as if that was a real issue. So, you know, buried in the 15,000 words is we will expect higher education providers not to encourage students to inform upon other students for lawful free speech, nor should they pay or otherwise reward students for doing so. Now, I just don't believe that there are people inside DfE that honestly think that Sheffield was wandering round paying students to inform on other students. And so you try really hard with this stuff. Certainly I've tried really hard to kind of do that kind of good faith engagement and to believe that there's something properly well-intentioned here about, you know, improving the ability of students to have debate on campus or be exposed to controversial ideas. But you read stuff like that and you think you've ruined it.
Yeah, and similarly, the stuff about scoring universities low or student unions low on, you know, having harassment policies and things like that, which, you know, for any common sense.
I think the wider question here goes back to the distaste at the Tony Blair 50% target and so on and so on, which is, I think the thing that the Conservative Party hasn't really worked out is if you have a high-skill economy, which is largely based around knowledge, a lot of that is going to involve going into higher education. But there's a fear that if you go from 1 in 20 or 1 in 30 people going into HE, being a bit left-wing for a while and then growing out of it, and moving to 1 in 2 people going into HE, being treated fairly badly in comparison to previous generations because they're having to pay more for it, and then develop a habit of being left-wing, there's a fear that they're being indoctrinated, and so you have to do something to HE to stop people being indoctrinated. And it's not dissimilar to this stuff that, you know, the panic about the National Trust, the BBC, and so on. There's this long march through the institutions, Marxist paranoia thing, and this sense that we must do something to the institutions to stop people being indoctrinated. And I'm not sure that's true, but it does look like that's what, you know, people in government believe, and I think that's where a lot of this comes from.
And I think short on policy levers to you know, do the big rebalancing of tertiary education that they keep talking about but not actually doing because of difficulty, perhaps ever so subtly trying to psych people out of going to universities, just making it sound like an increasingly unattractive place for parents, and kind of creating moral panics in a way that maybe will make parents think twice about sending their children there, because, as we know, the cost of the system, the cost of the HE funding system has got far higher than the Treasury would like.
I think the stars have aligned on this one. I think over the past couple of years, you've got classic libertarians that, you know, the kind of RCP Spiked types, you know, who believe in, you know, libertarianism. You've got social conservatives who, you know, believe what they've always believed and are kind of, you know, tacking to a kind of slightly older, you know, electorate. And you've got then a very specific debate, issues around transgender identity, sex, the role of that in policy, and so on and so on. When you combine all of those, I think you get these sorts of interventions. And, you know, for example, one of the most amusing things I think I've seen this week is lots of the classic libertarians looking at what's proposed going, oh my God, no, just because we've been saber rattling about this for 3 years, we didn't mean actually regulate, because the most important thing we believe in is no regulation.
Yeah, no one more regulation. Yeah.
So who's been stirring this up,
yeah,
folks?
Yeah.
So, you know, I wonder whether those stars, you know, there's a kind of temporary alignment there that might kind of move, particularly as we come out the back of the pandemic and, you know, tectonic plates of politics start to shift again.
I completely understand the points that Jim has made. I think I probably have a slightly different perspective on that. I'm not sure. I think it's sincere. I don't think that it's entirely bad faith. I think that they do think that there is an issue, whether you agree with it or not. I also think that something that we should explore or think about as a sector is that the impact of America on this discourse. And Helen Lewis, the writer from formerly of the New Statesman, now of the Atlantic, I think, right, has written really well about this for, in a different context. But because the, you know, the internet speaks American, particularly in the English language, and we are very, an American discourse tends to dominate. I think that the UK is often, and our cultural centres, universities, media, the arts, heritage worlds, and so on, a sort of a part of an American culture war, which, you know, and parts of some elements are, of those institutions are sort of adopting some of the tactics from the progressive left in America. And you'll see stuff that's going on in the New York Times at the moment and some of the other big institutions, which is I think, quite concerning. And then on the right-hand side, they exaggerate the issue because they're very worried that we're going to turn into this form of American culture war. And in the UK context, often people think of culture wars as what the Republicans and the extreme parts of the world, that's perhaps most of the Republican Party at the moment, are doing on American discourse. But, you know, I think there is a concern that what when America sneezes, we catch a cold, and that we're sort of being part of a wider American culture war within this.
Hilary, I want to give you the final word on the free speech stuff. What would your message be to universities right now in terms of how to handle this document and these proposals? And what would you like to see the sector kind of go back to government with?
So I would say to universities, just keep on working with your student unions and your students and keep making sure that the measures you have continue to be robust in making sure that free speech is promoted and protected. I think in regards to what universities need to do in relation to the sector, I think it's important that right now we are vocal about what is already going on and actually standing up for the good work that is done already, instead of sort of feeling like we have to lay down to whatever accusation is thrown at us from the government. And so I think right now it's a time to stand up and champion the already existing robust measures we have for protecting and promoting free speech, whilst also making sure that that is done for all students in a really authentic and widespread way, and especially thinking about more vulnerable groups that have been affected but not had the platform to speak about that so widely.
And you can find more details and our analysis of all of this issue on the site and in the show notes. Hello, I'm Wonky's Editor-in-Chief, Mark Leach, and I just want to take a moment of your time to tell you about an event we have coming up. Everyone can agree that university admissions should be fair, but decades of reviews have failed to achieve a lasting settlement. And in what appears to be an unprecedented moment of consensus, in recent months, policymakers, universities and students all agree that implementing some form of post-qualification admissions is now the way forward. But in what form? Join us on the 2nd of March for the Future Shape of Admissions, a Wonky at Home event in partnership with UCAS to discuss just that. We'll explore the options on the table for policy from PQA to PQB and think through their implications for universities, admissions professionals, schools and applicants. We'll hear fresh thinking from UCAS on possible models for admissions and stage the debate that will decide once and for all, we hope, whether the HE sector is really ready for post-qualification admissions. That's The Future Shape of Admissions, 2nd of March. Find out more and book your place now at wonky.com/events. So, despite the government's seemingly best efforts, applications to universities continue to rise. Hilary, talk us through the latest UCAS stats.
So the UCAS stats are out, you're right, and the application cycle has shown some really, really interesting things. The first thing that was really interesting to see was that 18-year-olds have increased in their applications to universities, but even more so, mature students have seen a 24% increase in going to university, which could be an indicator that people are continuing to see higher education as a stable sector to be a part of, especially during this pandemic. And so that was really, really interesting to see, especially because a lot of that increase fell into allied medicine subjects. So nursing was a big highlight of this application cycle, and perhaps this is to do with how much we've seen nursing students stand out in this pandemic by stepping in and supporting the NHS at such a hard time. What was also particularly interesting, given we are now in post-Brexit Britain, we are seeing that EU student applications have fallen, and that's really interesting because that could be an indicator of those international ties that we used to hold so strongly starting to break in a really significant way. So there's lots of interesting stuff in those stats, and it'd be interesting to see how that's going to manifest when students start actually going into universities later this year.
I mean, applications from the EU have fallen 40%. I would call that a complete collapse of the EU EU market, which is I guess not unexpected, but really quite tragic. We've also seen, I guess, there's the sort of the Chris Whitty effect keeps being talked about, doesn't it, Jim?
Yes, one of the papers said, are we seeing a Chris Whitty effect? Well, we might be. Look, one of the things it's important to do
is to not, you know, take what we imagine, which is, you know, the default Harry Potter student making lots of choices about higher education, leaving home and then, you know, returning again at the end of term, which is something I never stop banging on about, and assuming that what suddenly happened here is that Harry Potter has decided to become a nurse. You know, if you look at the numbers, we've also, you know, one of the big increases here is in mature applicants. So what we may well have with the nursing and subjects allied to healthcare thing is people in later life deciding that this is a good bet for retraining, which tells us some interesting things about where the response to Augur should go and that wider higher technical stuff and the support that should be put in place for, you know, adults who are retraining to be able to kind of, you know, launch a new career and so on. It might not tell us as much as we think about, you know, what 18-year-olds are suddenly deciding to do having read the newspapers. The other thing that strikes me in here is there has been a significant increase, not just in, you know, subjects allied to healthcare and the sort of stuff that would attract really good Leo data numbers, but also, for instance, a real increase in creative arts, up 10.68% over last year. So, you know, all of those market signalling efforts that the government has been launching around trying to persuade people to, you know, not take up what they would view as, you know, careers that don't pay the right, you know, amounts, clearly aren't working if we've got, you know, an over 10% increase in students applying to, you know, do creative arts.
Well, I can't really talk about the Chris Whitty effect, but what I was really interested in was actually seeing Paul Johnson from the IFS. He tweeted something this week about unemployment figures, and he exposed a big increase in unemployment amongst those who are lowest educated, but not really any increase in unemployment for graduates. And so I think this is obviously connected to this discussion about UCAS numbers, because whilst in times when the economy is weak, you know, graduate economic returns might not be as strong as we like, I think it's clear in general a degree offers, you know, much longer term resilience and protection in the employment market. And why I find it frustrating around the debate around access to higher education, around choice, is because it's around the issue of uncertainty. And I think as an individual, you're uncertain about what you want to do in future. You're uncertain about what the nature of the economy is going to be in 20, 30 years' time. You're going to be uncertain about your own personal life when you're an 18, 19, 20-year-old or even as a mature student. But that degree within that fog of uncertainty gives you probably is a rational decision, because it gives you that better longer-term resilience and protection and skills to thrive in whatever the economy is in the future. And so those people, those sceptics, parts in the government, outside of the government, that want to restrict access by both what you've achieved before or through the disciplines, you know, scepticism of certain subject choices and so on, I think are wrong, because ultimately, how can they know what's in the best interest of an individual in that fog of uncertainty in comparison to an individual? And I think that, you know, this is understood by students and their parents and others, and this is shown in those UCAS figures that are continue to be strong. And we've seen, and Hilary, you know, can talk about this much better than me, but in terms of the student experience over the last year, it's clearly been massively impacted and not what we'd like it to be. And yet, despite all of that, numbers continue to rise and the demand for higher education continues to grow.
I guess what I would say is that I think it's really encouraging to see that students are still wanting to pursue higher education. And after what has been a really, really rocky year where they haven't felt encouraged or like they've had much basis for having faith that they would be supported through that. What I think this is a really, really good indication of is that students still do want to go into higher education and are still really keen to go their full way throughout their educational experience. But I think that comes with a set of expectations that now need to be met by government and by universities. I think students want to see a real effort going towards making sure that they can have some sort of student experience, albeit different, in whatever university is going to look like in the next year or so, let alone post-pandemic. But I think what's going to be specifically important when I think about the nursing student is that the thing we've heard time and time again from students that are studying nursing or even just doing allied to medicine courses is that they need support. And so those cases for maintenance grants, for the abolition of tuition fees for them, for just greater support in that process is going to be even more compelling, seeing that those applications are going up and students want to do do those subjects, but need the supports to do those well, and feel supported in getting through that to join the NHS, which has been the hero definitely of this year, and we're seeing that going forward.
Now, every week on the show, we delve deep into the sector's past to discover stories of how things were and how things came to be. With Mike Ratcliffe, here's a hidden history of higher education.
One of the interesting things, if you think about the development of the English higher education sector, is how come the Scots, by the end of the 16th century, have five universities and the English only have two. Aberdeen has as many universities as England has. So why does this, we end up in this very strange situation? Well, one of those key reasons is that Oxford and Cambridge get quite comfortable being universities, and they are very good at patronising the king and getting the king to stop other universities. So there are two key examples of where the established universities kill off the opposition that they have. So the first of these is the University of Northampton. So Northampton, which now has a perfectly nice university, doesn't have any lecture theatres, but it has a perfectly nice university. And its original university in the city was founded way back, time of Henry III, and it's another offshoot. So problems at Oxford, some of the students get up and go, they coalesce in Northampton. But the problem is that this is a time of civil war, and so the students there, although the university gets going, they pick the wrong side. So they pick Simon de Montfort's rebels. And so when the King's army comes near Northampton, they use their arrows and bows, or their bows and arrows even, to fire on the King's troops. So this doesn't endear the King to the students of Northampton, because they're clearly rebellious and they don't like him. But meanwhile, the University of Oxford has decided, well, it's not very keen on Northampton. It's a bit close in terms of its monopoly. And it petitions the King to say, can we have this place stopped, because it will harm our city of Oxford. And he gets the bishops on his side, and therefore the king has a writ, and the University of Northampton is dissolved and got rid of. And the other attempt comes in Stamford in Lincolnshire, which sadly doesn't have a university to this day, a fine FE college, but no university. And it gets another offshoot university. A group of rebellious scholars get up and go. Migration is a technique used all over Europe to found new universities. So they migrate and off they go. But again, there's a petition from the two existing universities to have it stopped. And so they get the king to issue another writ. And what's fun in its kind of scheme of things is that Oxford inserts a clause into the oath that you swear to become a master. When you take your Master of Arts degree, you swear an oath. You uphold the statutes of the university. But you also uphold an oath never to teach at Stamford. So in the oath that they then continue to swear for the next 500 years, everyone is absolutely saying that you'll only teach at Oxford and Cambridge and never at Stamford. So they have to get rid of this clause in the beginning of the 19th century, because actually some people say, well, I can't teach at UCL. What becomes UCL? Because I swear on this oath that I can't possibly do this anymore. Oh, that's wildly out of date. So Oxford and Cambridge do their best to get rid of other university. The Scots have a much more sensible system, because I think there's a whole range of different factors, but travel is more complex, but they also see the value of having universities in different places. So different kings found, I mean, effectively tiny universities, but they have much more of a local feel. So students from the locale go to that university. They don't build halls of residence. People stay much more locally linked. And so by the time they get to the University of Edinburgh being founded, it's a town university. It's a sense that the town wants to have a university, and it gets a royal charter to do so. But it's about creating them. So because Aberdeen ends up being reformed by them setting up a different college. So there's King's College and there's Marshall College. They set up a different college in the same city. And so Aberdeen officially has two universities until they're united in the 19th century. Hence, Aberdeen has as many universities as England has anomaly. So we get into a kind of a weird situation in terms of suppressing competition.
Right, Heppy is back this week with a new report from former Times Education editor Rosemary Bennett on universities and the media. Richard, what jumped out at you from this?
So this is Rosie Bennett's Heppy report on the relationship between universities and the media and how universities can get a better press. And the report delves into why universities have faced greater scrutiny in recent years. And her argument, which is I think is a pretty convincing one to me, is that universities, as they've expanded, impacted more lives, fees have increased, have really become a consumer story, and one where the media tends to take the side of the underdog student, the consumer, rather than the institution. What I also find really interesting in this report is the pressure on the journalists, the pressure on Rosie and her colleagues to get their articles in the news pages every single day, convincing the news desk that their story should be more prominent or put in those top few pages. And what she said here was what was really important for her is being able to provide her news desk with a simple narrative. And I suppose that combination of a simple narrative aligned with the consumer focus over recent years is why issues around value for money, senior management pay and grade inflation and so on have been so prevalent. And she comes up with some interesting perspectives on what universities should do to improve the relationship with the media, use VCs more as public figures, offer more insight in terms of educational stories and say more about the wider educational landscape. And I think I think it exposes two really big things, which I think are probably well known, but this really highlights is A, universities need a really good top drawer press office, and they're going to have to put significant resource in that, particularly as this is not going away. And secondly, the critical importance of leadership and ensuring that vice chancellors are sort of and their team really get to grips with the media and know how to handle it.
This point about higher education is now a consumer story, not about kind of research or education, was also the big takeaway for me. I wonder, Hillary, kind of what you know, where can student unions kind of ally with universities on this point? Because I think it seems to me that, you know, a lot of the kind of old-fashioned way of thinking about universities and the press has been about, as I say, placing stories about, you know, innovation and research breakthroughs and the kind of great kind of stuff that goes on campus. But actually, there is the media interest is about students and from a kind of consumer point of view, particularly the Times, you know, Rosemary's former paper, which wants to sell newspapers to essentially parents of students and parents of prospective students to help in, kind of inform their view.
Yeah, I think traditionally we've seen that universities normally like to use media when they want to celebrate an achievement or call themselves set to leading in something or the other. And I think as good as that is, I think where student unions have been particularly effective in sort of tempering what can sometimes seem robotic and not necessarily personal is that student unions have just been brilliant. And I did quite a bit of work with our media team when I was back at Bristol, just bringing that human aspect to what universities do and what they are. And I think what's particularly important is that I think what I find is that the stories of real students on the ground and their real experiences of university is what people want to know about and what people want to hear. And I think the more that universities look to humanize themselves instead of being these big sort of institutions that put out really formal statements rather than sort of these institutions made up of human beings with stories to tell and experiences to share, then they're never going to shake off that sort of bad relationship that they have with media in terms of how the marketization of higher education has framed them as sort of businesses that you know that hurt consumers who students are framed as. And I think this is a real indication that right now the consumer business marketized model, whatever you want to call it, that has been adopted by this government and run through to universities, just doesn't work in really serving the purpose of how much universities are impactful for students and how much they are made up of students that have stories to tell and things to share constantly. And I think that's really, really important when we think about that ongoing relationship with the media in universities.
I mean, Jim, you probably follow or track the kind of media's coverage of universities more than in this country more than anyone. I would probably, I think it's fair to say, because your Twitter feed automates literally every single story that comes out. What do you recognise here from Rosemary's analysis, and kind of what? You know, you've been tracking this for, you know, 10 years now or more.
Yeah, a long time. I mean, look, the paper is terrific, a real classic in its genre, I think, in terms of kind of scooping up lots of things that have been going on and making you think. The thing I'd say that is undercooked in the paper is that to some extent the media kind of likes to have its cake and eat it on this one. So, you know, there are as many consumer underdog, people have paid fees, what a rip-off stories, as there are
you know, Harry Potter HE, you know, big school, big boarding school at that, stories. And it seems to me that if you were to, you know, find the vanishing point of those, they're not necessarily compatible. Either students are empowered consumers buying a sophisticated service provision product, or they're to be treated like kids at big school, or at least, you know, kids at boarding school and so on. And the media, of course, draws on, for different parts of its audiences, different tropes there in order to place different types of stories at a given point. And sometimes even both of those tropes, you know, it coexist in the same story.
You know, one minute the press wants to know when students are going to get a refund. The following minute, the press wants to know when students are going to be fined and thrown out of their student accommodation for, you know, socialising during a pandemic.
I do think there's something very interesting about the way this year has played out and the position that universities have found themselves in, which for fairly obvious reasons has had to dial down the empowered consumer having an amazing, great value experience and dial up the kids at big school are going to have to poke up with it because we're in the middle of a pandemic. You know, I kind of understand that universities have had to do that, but that does mean they've been in for an extraordinarily difficult ride. And it's the bit about parents that I think that Rosemary really brings to life. You know, one of the things that strikes me in the thing I read yesterday, you know, that thing that's been round about £1 billion in wasted rent, right? That's been a really big story that Save the Student calculated and put out. One of the things in Save the Student's accommodation survey is that parents are shelling out £3,000 a year contributions to their students, to their kids' rent. And that's without all the other costs. £3,000 a year in hidden parental contribution to rent. And, you know, those are the circumstances under which a sector that stresses the, well, you know, it's very difficult, but we're doing our best. And you know, look at all the money we've put into COVID secure preparations. The sector's going to find that really, really difficult when it, on one level or another, has been a participant in and has caused, you know, a hell of a lot of people to shell out for rent they didn't need to shell out for. So, look, I think some of the conclusion off of Rosemary's report is about how the sector talks to the press and the stories it seeks to place. But actually, it's also sometimes about the decisions the sector makes, why it makes them, and its behaviour in public, whether it's seen to be arguing for and fighting for the interests of students and parents in public or just doing it in private and often losing.
And if I may add, I think that's really, really interesting, reflecting on how that's played out through the pandemic, especially because I think what has been really, really interesting is that the personal and the professional has really, really overlapped in a way that can't be separated anymore. And I think university sort of common practice of waiting to do things behind the scenes and then putting out public statements in really formal ways has just not worked when, for example, parents who a lot of these things are targeted at want to hear a very human story of, for example, a vice chancellor that also has a child at university or a young adult or mature student at university who recognizes that they have a personal investment in making sure that their own children get justice, and that is something that translates to the rest of the student body in an equitable way. And I think sort of this age of putting out press statements and making sure that, you know, whatever universities put out are reputationally secure just doesn't work to really speak in a very realistic and thoughtful way to the issues that, you know, universities have been complicit in and also have been impacted by in terms of how students are being impacted by this system that they are trying to work through.
Richard, just before we wrap up, I mean, reading this report, what do you think should be the kind of the main takeaways? So for a comms team in university, assuming that they're not going to be able to justify having a massive ramp up of resource anytime soon, what do you think kind of professional comms outfits could be doing right now?
So I think that this will be, I think comms outfits will enjoy this a lot. I think my main takeaway from this is actually it needs to be read by others outside of the comms outfits from universities. It needs to be read obviously by vice chancellors, office governors, but also by academic colleagues, particularly those that have been criticising the sort of increase in the number of administrative staff within universities and expose really what the pressures universities under and why there needs to be a ramping up and additional resource for comms teams within universities. Can I just take a couple of other things? We talked about at the top of the show around free speech. And to some extent, this sort of just got me thinking about how free speech, from in one perspective, is a consumer issues story. The fact about their rights to have free speech as a student or so on. And I think that you'll see that element of consumerism is in a variety of stories that we'll see across the sector, and it's something to be aware of. Secondly, where I thought this was terrific, like Jim and others have said around the paper, really enjoyed it and a fantastic read. Where I think that I would have liked to have had more from Rosie on is around the conflict of collective action problems around exposing your institution or your vice chancellor to debate when it might be in the interest of that individual or that institution not to be out front and talk about those issues. But for the sector as a whole, it's problematic if people don't then engage in these discussions. You know, there's a classic example that she talked about. She's quite supportive of Louise Richardson talking about VC pay and saying that she was the only VC that was actually willing to talk about that issue at the time. But of course, it probably, let's be honest, would have been better for Louise Richardson and for Oxford if she hadn't have done that, because she compared her salary to bankers and footballers, which was probably not the right thing to do. So there is this conflict between actually needing to defend your position to support the wider sector, but how it can expose you as an individual or your institution.
So that's about it for this week. Remember, to delve deeper into anything we discussed today, you'll find links in the show notes. Don't forget, you can subscribe to the podcast automatically. Just search for The Wonky Show via Apple Podcasts or your favourite Android podcast directory, or find the feed you need on wonky.com/podcast. So thanks to Hillary, Richard, Jim, and everyone else at Team Wonky for making it happen behind the scenes. Until next week, stay safe, stay wonky.